Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
The title of our second conference is The Dilemma Facing Teachers of Religion. I have called this lecture The Dilemma Facing Teachers of Religion in order to point out the practical effect which the crisis in the modern world has had on parents and teachers who are confronted with two apparently conflicting philosophies of existence. I am speaking of those parents and teachers who are still sincere and deeply committed Catholic Christians and who want to share their own commitment with others, specifically with those whom God has placed under their parental or pedagogical care. I don't think the two terms are mutually exclusive. What are these two conflicting philosophies which create the dilemma? The first is the Christian philosophy, which is convinced, reasonably and on faith, that God is infinitely perfect, and therefore his immutable essence is the divinely determining pattern for creation. According to this same philosophy, the all-perfect God became man in the person of Christ, who called himself the Way, the Truth, and the Life. He called himself the Way because, so he claimed, only through his person and his teaching can the human race reach its final eternal destiny. He called himself the Truth because his doctrine, so he taught, is essentially immutable, since Christ is the unchangeable God in human form. And he called himself the Life, because as God, what he possesses by nature is the life that he promised to communicate by grace to all who believe in him and are ready to obey his will and follow his example. So much for the first philosophy of existence. The other philosophy is antithetical to the preceding one. It is at once agnostic, pragmatic, and evolutionary. It is agnostic because it claims simply not to know for sure whether there is an infinite, immutable God, and less sure still that such a God, if he exists, had actually become incarnate as Jesus Christ. This philosophy is pragmatic because it knows only the present world of space and time, and with hard-headed realism wants to enjoy what this, the only sure world that exists, offers in the material and cultural blessings that the genius of science is now bestowing in such abundance on mankind. This philosophy is thirdly evolutionary because it prefers to think that nothing is stable or set. Nothing just is. Everything, including God, has an unpredictable and hopefully greater and greater future. How are teachers of religion, whether parents or professional pedagogues, to react to these conflicting philosophies? Or in other words, what is their dilemma? Suppose I put it this way. Is the only option for Catholic parents and teachers to choose between these two philosophies? So that if they choose the first, they retain their Catholicism, but simply ignore every value, even hidden or implicit, in the philosophy of agnostic, pragmatic, evolutionism? Or if they choose the second, do they necessarily abdicate their faith in God and Christ, and every vestige of Christianity? My thesis is that as conflicting as these two philosophies are in fact, and they cannot be reconciled in principle, but a Catholic can remain as firm as ever in his faith, with no compromise in doctrine or Christian morals, and yet he can learn from the insights and methods and approaches to the world which those who may lack the Christian vision possess and practice. For the sake of conciseness, I wish to identify some of these insights and approaches with a view to placing the dilemma we are talking about into correct focus. In other words, it's not an either-or dilemma. The dilemma, as I see it, is not whether anything substantive of Catholic Christianity must be sacrificed in modern religious education. It is rather whether religious educators will teach with or without reference to the valid developments in today's world of knowledge explosion. Notice I assume there are such valid developments, and I submit that they can be useful, even necessary instruments, for the better and more effective communication of the gospel in the 20th century. I wish to take up each of the three features of what we conveniently call modern secularism, its agnostic, pragmatic, and evolutionary temperament, to see what elements in each of this triad deserve serious attention from religious educators today. By serious attention, I mean serious consideration, in order to profit from, and where feasible, incorporate into, Catholic religious education our findings from what is necessarily, as a philosophy, not authentically Catholic. In each case, I will begin with the adjective which describes the modern world. First, we say it is agnostic. Certainly, by any standard we use, modern mentality is agnostic. The agnosticism, be it noted, is not universal and still less comprehensive. It does not say that nothing can be known. That would be nihilism. Quite the contrary. We know more now than we ever did before. So it is not the fact of knowledge which is called into question. Nor, for that matter, is it the scope of knowledge that is being challenged. The very word science is the English transliteration of the Latin scientia, which means knowledge. No, not only do we know more today, but about more things than were ever dreamt possible as recently as 100 years ago. What then is agnostic about the agnosticism of the modern world from which religious educators can profit? It is rather the quality of this knowledge which the agnostic attitude challenges. The quality of our knowledge, so the agnostic approach argues, is always provisional knowledge, hypothetical knowledge. That is, it is knowledge which serves as a useful hypothesis until some new experiment or discovery comes along to supplant what was, after all, only a workable theory to begin with. What relevance does this have for the teaching of religion? It should put the parent or the teacher on his guard against complacency. If he ever thought so before, he should know now that he can no longer assume, as parents and teachers perhaps too easily assume, that just because a child or student knows the book provided answers to catechism questions, he therefore also firmly believes and is intellectually convinced that what he is expected to believe is true. Let's make sure for the present, because we will need it later on, there is a difference between believing and being convinced that what I believe is true. The modern agnostic attitude should further place a new and different responsibility on the teacher of Christian mysteries like the Incarnation, the Real Presence, the Life of Grace, and the Papal Primacy. To enough as mysteries, their final motive for acceptance is the authority of God who revealed them. But faith is not the same as credulity. Credulity is believing without having a reason for one's faith. All too many children, I fear, had been brought up on the naive supposition that just because God revealed certain truths, there was no further need to make these truths rationally credible and historically validated. I think we are now paying the price for this pedagogical failure in seeing men and women mature indeed in years and not a few under vows or in sacred orders who suddenly discovered, as they tell me, that they no longer believe what they had so piously accepted before. That is the hub of the problem. Pious acceptance on the word of father or mother, of teacher or textbook, was never adequate foundation for what St. Paul justly calls the reasonable sacrifice of the mind in faith. And it had better be reasonable. Either the mysteries of revelation are simultaneously shown to be reasonable, indeed perfectly consonant with the severest demands of human intelligence, or in today's climate of agnostic uncertainty, these mysteries become first misty, then dubious, and are finally scuttled altogether. They were useful props in childhood, and maybe early adolescence, but they are no longer tenable, so a lot of people claim, by a mature adult who has no sound reasons for believing. So much for the adjective agnostic. Our second level of analysis is covered by the word pragmatic. We are all familiar with Marx's diatribe against religion as a fraud, because its only purpose is to promise future happiness in heaven for a present life of misery. This kind of pragmatism has a salutary lesson for religious education. It is unfortunately possible to so teach Christianity as to leave the definite impression to a believer that he must expect nothing but suffering and sorrow here on earth. in exchange, if you wish, for beatitude in the life to come. No one is undervaluing the role of the cross in the life of a true Christian. In other words, if any intention on my part to minimize those basic passages in the Gospels, like deny yourselves, take up your cross daily, and follow me, or he that loves father or mother, yes, and even himself more than me, he is not worthy of me. Assuredly, the true follower of Christ knows that his master was persecuted and crucified, and he remembers those incisive words, "The servant is not greater than his master." But, and it's on that adversity that so much of the future success of successful religious education will depend. Having said all of this, is that all there is to the Gospels? Is it not equally true that Christ promised, no doubt at the cost of self-sacrifice, happiness here on earth? He said, happy are the poor in spirit. Happy are the gentle. Happy are those who hunger and thirst for what is right. Happy are the merciful. Happy are the pure of heart. Then to dramatize still more emphatically what this means, on the evening of Easter Sunday, Christ commanded his followers, "Peace be with you." And he repeated the mandate to make sure the apostles would have no doubt that Christ died for mankind not only to redeem us from sin, but deliver us from the sense of guilt by conferring the joy of his peace in this life on all who trust in his mercy. It is not possible to read the letters of St. Paul without capturing the happiness of spirit which he enjoyed, and which he repeatedly told the first Christians they had a right, that's the word, a right to expect, not only in the eternal future, but in the temporal present. So we return to our theme. Modern pragmatism, which looks for immediate returns from its investments and a here and now assurance that something is worth buying, should teach teachers of religion that Christianity too is profoundly, indeed divinely, pragmatic. That the happiness it gives to its believers is not only eschatological, but earthly, not only celestial, but terrestrial, not only in the eventual then, but in the present now. This is not the same as saying that young Christians should be taught to expect a quid pro quo kind of a business return in this life for their loyalty to the faith or their faithful practice of virtue. After all, there is such a virtue as hope, which means the firm desire of good things still to come. And this life, and we don't have to teach the children this, even at its best, this life is not yet paradise. So we don't have to fear of overreaching the mark. The problem has been that we have underreached it. Christianity has a built-in pragmatism that cannot be ignored, and in teaching should not be ignored without grave consequences to believers. It promises, on the promise of its founder, the experience of joy in the possession of God who dwells in the heart of the Christian. It offers the satisfaction of deep down peace of soul, such as no other merely human enterprise can give. And it guarantees to those who love Christ a responsive love from Him here in this world that has to be felt to be understood, and that only those who honestly try to love Christ can understand. But you begin to see one of the qualities that a Christian educator must have. He must have experienced the presence of God in his heart and have sensed the dwelling of Christ in his soul. Otherwise, as only the young can tell us, they will call us phonies.
This conference is continued on Side B.